From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was Kimberly Diaz, one of many speakers at a rally in New York's Washington Square Saturday, as thousands gathered for an event called Rise Up October Against Police Violence.
I'm here because, like you, I had to decide which side I was on. I had to decide what role I was going to play in ending the mass incarceration, the murder of innocent people every single day. And a part of that choice came with realizing the truth about this country. This country was founded on genocide. Never forget that. This country was founded and a system was created based on the enslavement of people brought here against their will.
Following the rally featuring dozens of family members and friends of victims of police violence, thousands marched up New York's 6th Avenue to mark the 20th annual march commemorating October 22, 1996, a nationwide day of protest against police brutality. Many of the marchers Saturday, however, said this was their first demonstration and that recent high-profile police murders and the uprisings they inspired in places like Ferguson and Baltimore made them come out to be involved. And while Rise Up October activists were demonstrating in New York, families of victims of police violence were testifying before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington. The commission is an investigatory arm of the Organization of American States. Officials from the U.S. State Department and the Department of Justice were also on hand, as was Attorney Justin Hansford, who testified before the commission. Hansford is a professor at the St. Louis University School of Law and was involved in a black citizen suit against police departments in St. Louis County. He said the U.S. criminal justice system is soaked in blood and should be dismantled.
The United States asks us to assume that these systematic extrajudicial killings result from a long-running mishap or the simple failure of attempts at colorblind criminal justice. But today I'm going to ask you, Commission, to shift your lens. In general, the discriminatory laws on policing and criminal justice are holdovers drafted by state lawmakers who maybe a few years earlier drafted Jim Crow poll tax laws as a way to ensure white domination through pretext. What if our criminal justice problems are not as unintentional as a few bad apples here and there, but as intentional as policy choices? What if the system is not inefficient or in need of reform, but working exactly as it was designed to work?
The militarization of U.S. society is as old as the American system itself, but the policy kicked into high gear in the 1960s to crush the rising number of black urban revolts. Thus begins an article entitled, Militarization of U.S. Police is a Reflection of United States Foreign Policy, by Abayomi Ezekwe, executive editor of the Pan-African Newswire. We spoke with him from Detroit via Skype Tuesday. I wanted to talk with you about your recent piece that compares the way the police operate in the United States with U.S. foreign policy.
Yes, it's definitely a comparison because of the burgeoning economic crisis here in the United States and the rising consciousness, particularly among youth, who are fed up with the police terrorism that they're subjected to on a daily basis. The fact that they are going out demonstrating and engaging in urban rebellions has prompted the revealing of all of this militarized police equipment that is being utilized against people here in this country in the same fashion that it has been in other states throughout the world over the last two decades.
In your piece, you actually begin back in the 60s with the militarization of police here, the military tactics used against such as the Black Panther Party and the whole COINTELPRO program, the use of military weapons on the streets and the creation of SWAT teams and all types of military tactics being imported or redeployed back here in the country. Do you want to trace the history of that a little bit?
Yes. Well, 50 years ago, we had a turning point in not only African-American but U.S. history with the rebellion in Watts section of Los Angeles, although it extended beyond that area. And this was quite a shock to the U.S. administration of Lyndon Johnson. Just 5 days prior to the eruption of the Watts Rebellion, he had signed the 1965 Voting Rights Act, supposedly securing his position 100 years after the conclusion of the Civil War in regard to making the United States a, quote, equal and free society, unquote. However, the rising expectations of the African-American people during the mid-1960s shattered that whole illusion by the U.S. state. And after Watts, we had, of course, a series of rebellions in 1966 in Chicago and Cleveland and other cities. And then, of course, in 1967, it reached an apex with rebellions in over 160 cities throughout the United States. Detroit, where I'm based at, of course, being the largest and most violent urban rebellion in the history of the United States. It changed the character of policing inside the country. Numerous federal agencies, academics, the corporate media flooded into Detroit in the aftermath of the 1967 rebellion to try to figure out what happened. Who actually was involved in these rebellions? Why did they revolt? What were the social conditions that actually prompted the rebellion? And they agreed on two things, at least the purported liberal wing of the ruling class during that time period. One was that the violence had to stop. When Lyndon Johnson delivered a speech on July 25th of 1967, actually it was July 24th of 1967, where he was ordering federal troops into the city of Detroit. He said that violence, arson, pillage had nothing to do with civil rights. It had to stop. They had to reinstitute law and order. Then at the same time, they had another message that they had to create opportunities for African Americans to, quote, integrate, to unquote, themselves into the broader mainstream of American society. Well, they remembered the first part of that proclamation, but they forgot about the last part. So what we've seen over the last 4.5 decades or more is a further militarization, not only of the police, but of U.S. society as a whole. And at the same time, a failure to address the fundamental structural issues that have locked tens of millions of people, many of whom are African Americans, but people from other groups too, Latinos, people from European American extraction as well, into a marginalized working class status. We saw the rapid expansion of the prison industrial complex during the 1970s. After 1980, the prison population has gone up some 500% between 1980 and 2015 over the last 3.5 decades. And there's really no end in sight, absent of a revolutionary movement that can encompass, you know, all of these oppressed groups to fight against this growing class division in American society.
That growth in mass incarceration is a bipartisan project, right? That Nixon was the first to announce the war on drugs, but all the way through Bill Clinton, you saw all kinds of legislation that added huge numbers to the prison population. You had the three strikes law by Clinton and the sentencing disparities, in particular for cocaine. And
those things, although they were initiated at the federal level, became modeled after at the state level as well. And there was a series of explosions of this population that you can trace on a graph.
Most definitely. And as I mentioned in the article, beginning as early as the mid-1960s, you had not only congressional legislation, but you had an executive mandate to further militarize the police. Between 1964, 1965, and 1968, there were hundreds of urban rebellions throughout the United States. We saw the emergence of many radical and revolutionary organizations, the most well-known of which have been groups such as the Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa. In Detroit, we had the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. These organizations went beyond the traditional demands of the civil rights movement and calling for a fundamental restructuring of U.S. society. In fact, in 1965, there was an Office of Law Enforcement Assistance that was set up by the U.S. Department of Justice. Now, this was a predecessor to the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which was established as a result of the work of the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice. And by 1968, as a result of a congressional commission on so-called crime in the streets, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the LEAA, was created continuing into the early 1980s. Now, after the early 1980s, we saw the rapid expansion of the building of prisons and other correctional facilities. Now we have the highest per capita prison population of any other country in the world. There are well over 2 million people that are incarcerated. Many more under law enforcement and judicial supervision. We have an educational system in many urban areas that mirrors prison-like conditions. We often hear about the school-to-prison pipeline. So all of these developments have been taking place since the mid to late 1960s. For example, there was an ominous Crime Control and Safe Streets Act that was passed in 1968. It authorized the providing of funds to create state planning agencies in each state throughout the U.S. that would have as its primary function the responsibility to develop a comprehensive statewide plan for the improvement of law enforcement throughout each individual state. The act also it authorized the states to make grants from a population-based block grant allocation program to units of local government to carry out programs and projects in accordance with the planning effort to improve law enforcement. So these are code words for not only the mass incarceration of African Americans and other oppressed groups and working class, marginalized groups and poor people in general, but also a method of social containment and taking millions of people out of the labor market where you don't have to, of course, worry about providing jobs, a guaranteed annual income, housing, quality education, universal health care, environmental quality. All of that is off the table when the narrative is that the principal concern of the federal government, state governments, and local governments is the curbing of crime and other forms of what they describe as antisocial behavior.
I mean, we saw an example of what's happened in the schools just this past week with the takedown of that young girl. And what I noticed in the reporting of that was that the other kid that was arrested by the police was charged with disrupting school. That's apparently a crime now.
Yes, and we've seen beginning during the late 1960s the placing of law enforcement personnel in schools, and that has been a continuation for the last four and a half decades. We've also seen, for example, in Detroit, they created what was known as an Educational Administration Authority. Educational Achievement Authority, the EAA, and many of the students who were sent to these schools are, quote, at-risk, unquote, students. And they described the conditions there as being like being in some type of juvenile facility. Now, recently, if you read the local newspapers in Detroit, much corruption has been revealed about this EAA, this Educational Achievement Authority, where you have no-bid contracts, where you have all types of corruption that is going on. There's no real education taking place in these institutions, yet they have an ideological underpinning, and that is these institutions, just like the charter schools and just like the privatization of K through 12 education, is inherently superior to traditional public education. Now, I'm not saying that there were no problems with the public education system in urban areas and even in the suburbs, in small towns and in rural areas, but what is being instituted now is far worse than what people have been subjected to over the last several decades. So, corruption is inherent in this entire process, but it's based and driven on ideological and political aims, which is to not only contain and not only to disempower, but also to, in fact, exploit the conditions of growing numbers of people inside the United States. For example, the prison industrial complex is just not a system of warehousing. Prisoners are working while they are being incarcerated. They're manufacturing products. They're providing services that workers could be providing outside of prison walls. So these are displaced workers who are actually being exploited on a super exploitative level inside these correctional facilities. You know, many people say that slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment, but there's a clause within the 13th Amendment, which indicates that if one is incarcerated, you can in fact be treated like a slave. And with the increasing character of incarceration of the U.S. population, then this level of exploitation will inevitably increase.
And you're talking about adding millions of people to that, essentially to that slave workforce over the last 30, 40 years.
Yes, this is what's going on. But at this point, there's some indications that it has reached a level where it is no longer profitable, at least not profitable to the degree that it was perhaps 20 years ago. So now they're trying to figure out other methods of super exploitation of the poor and the working and the oppressed people here in this country. There was an announcement several weeks ago that approximately 6,000 people will be released from federal prisons in the United States because apparently it's no longer as profitable as it had been. But at the same time, you still have other methods of social containment and incarceration. And we see it particularly in a city like Ferguson, Missouri, where we had a rebellion a little over a year ago. And even the New York Times did a study indicating that out of a population of 21,000 people, there were 12,000 outstanding warrants. A lot of them dealt with supposed traffic violations. So we have this racial profiling that is taking place, where African Americans are being pulled over for driving vehicles, being given two, three, four different citations, which are at extortious prices. If you don't meet those requirements, a warrant is put out for your arrest. You can be incarcerated. That was exposed. Now they supposedly have some amnesty program where you can come in and make arrangements to pay off these fines. And this is being done. And in fact, the evidence of this was uncovered by the U.S. Justice Department Ferguson report, where they had emails and other forms of communication where they actually plotted to increase the level of traffic stops, the issuing of citations in order to finance these suburban municipalities in St. Louis County. And this is just not an isolated incident. This is happening throughout the length and breadth of the United States, where you have African Americans and others being targeted by law enforcement for the purpose of generating revenue for these municipalities where the federal revenue sharing dollars and the state revenue sharing dollars have been decreased over the last several years due to the fact that more and more incentives have to be provided to private capital, ostensibly to provide jobs that unfortunately are never really produced for the people who need them.
And then in the last decade, in the aftermath, as they say, of September 11th, with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, the integration of local police forces into a national police force de facto has occurred and been accelerating. What do you think of the implications of that?
There are grave implications to this. In fact, there is really no, at present, threat to national security inside the United States. Some 13 years after the attacks at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, there's been essentially no mass uprising or upheaval that would threaten the national security of the U.S. state. So what they have done is utilize this as a mechanism for not only monitoring people, but also preparing for what they perceive to be an inevitable national uprising. This cannot continue forever. There cannot be a situation where you have tens of millions of people living in poverty, without adequate jobs, living in environmental degradation, and other forms of exploitation and oppression, such as poor schools, poor city services, the theft of employment and social services, without there being an eventual uprising on a national level. So I think the Department of Homeland Security is really more geared towards the potential domestic uprising inside the United States. Now, they utilize the purported threat of terrorism as a means of providing a justification and a rationale for the continuation of spending, I would say, approximately $1 trillion annually of tax dollars, not only for defense, which is over $600 billion, but also the unlimited budgets of the Homeland Security Agency, such as the Central Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the National Security Agency, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Border Patrol. All of these units, in essence, have unlimited budgets. And this is done in a way to ensure that the ruling elites, the so-called 1%, which now is probably far less than 1%, maintain their authority and maintain their power. You see in urban areas, for example, like Detroit and Chicago and St. Louis and even New York City, where more and more quote, authority, unquote, is being taken away from the electorate and turned over to authorities, to so-called nonprofit organizations, which are really fronts for corporate interests. And people are not allowed even to vote, for example, on what form of government they're going to have, whether or not public assets can be transferred to private interests. Somehow, this is above the heads and beyond the capacity of ordinary people, particularly oppressed people, to make decisions in regard to these critical issues. So what they're doing, they're taking public assets, turning them over to private interests, and then justifying this under the guise of economic development, of efficiency, and of fighting corruption. But the real corruption of the banks and the corporations, which has robbed the people inside the United States and the world of trillions of dollars just over the last 7 years since the financial crash of 2008. And this bailout of the banks and the corporations and the mega insurance companies is continuing. The Federal Reserve is still turning over billions of dollars every month to the financial institutions. You still have tax breaks and abatements being given to multinational corporations to, quote, invest, unquote, in municipalities to build prestige projects which may create a lot of construction jobs initially, but in the long term create very few jobs, but in fact bring about windfall profits for the elites.
If you look at Detroit as one example, maybe for some context, you could tell people what's happened there.
Well, here we had the deliberate targeting of the African-American and Latino communities for predatory lending in mortgages. That began in the late 1990s. And they set up schemes where they would extend credit to homeowners, knowing that they would not be able to meet the terms of those loans. Detroit had the highest per capita home ownership of by African Americans of any other city in the United States. And that has been virtually reversed just over the last decade. We then, as a result of the decline in home ownership and the theft of jobs by the automobile companies and other industrial sectors of the economy, this, of course, drove down the tax revenues of the municipality here in Detroit, and as well as the broader county of Detroit and the broader state of Michigan. So in order to address this shortfall in revenue, the banks and other financial institutions extended predatory loans in regard to municipal finance, which the people in the city and the officials in the city were in no position to meet the terms of these agreements. About 2.5 years ago, we did a Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Law downtown in Detroit, where we got thousands upon thousands of documents on these bogus bond deals, interest rate swaps, termination fees that have cost the people of the city of Detroit hundreds of millions of dollars. Then, of course, driving the city into what they described as emergency management, where you essentially took away the right of the local elected officials to govern. Now, this was put to a vote because of a referendum drive on the part of concerned residents of the state of Michigan. The emergency manager law was actually defeated at the polls in 2011, yet the right-wing government in Lansing, headed by Rick Snyder, and the majority right-wing Republican legislature, and the reason why they exist is because they've redrawn the districts. It's a form of sophisticated gerrymandering. They reimposed emergency management over and above the political will of the people of the state of Michigan. People, not just people in Detroit, voted against emergency management. It was voted down across the state of Michigan, yet it was imposed anyway. And what they did through the emergency manager process was to attack the pension funds, to attack the health care programs, municipal employees, as well as retirees. In essence, they stole at least $7 billion from retirees and the residents of the city of Detroit during this bankruptcy process, which they illegally filed during 2013 and rushed through a bankruptcy, which was concluded in about 15 months, leaving pensioners short anywhere between 20 and up to 40% of their pensions, abolishing their health care benefits, taking institutions like the Detroit Public Works, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, and turn them over to regional authorities, to private entities, in an effort to disempower and also to inflate the wealth of the 1%. So these are just one example of what has happened here in the United States. It's going on in many other cities. In Chicago, for example, they have a serious problem with the public school system. They closed down over 50 schools. They're trying to figure out a methodology of attacking municipal pensions in Illinois. I mean, these are trillions of dollars of deferred wages of working people across the United States that are right now being attacked by the banks and the financial institutions and the bond rating agencies and the bond securitization agencies. So it's a whole massive transfer of wealth from the working people, the so-called middle class people, to the most wealthiest individuals and institutions in U.S. society and indeed internationally.
Abiyomi Ezekwe from the Pan-African Newswire, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.